This is Audible.
Vaults of Terror. The Hollow Mountain. Written by Chris Raitt. Read by John Banks. Chapter 1. Nirkazad was alive. It had been borderline for a while. Irunian, Curvain's chirurgeon philosophical, had worked patient hours over her, adjusting the vials and the sutures, snagging and twisting the flesh, until she was finally stabilized and her heart was beating and her lungs were pulling in air. When she awoke at last, it was his skinny face that she saw first, peering over half-moon spectacles, as if scrutinizing a disappointing lab specimen.
"You're tough," he admitted.
She knew that. Being born and raised on a death world had given her no alternative. During her long career, she'd suffered frequent and significant physical trauma and had always pulled through. On the mag anchor platforms in low orbit over Dramda 11, she'd taken a bolt round through her shoulder that had pulled a fist-sized chunk of flesh with it. That should have killed her, as should the poison-laced spike in her stomach under the hive slums of Hydra Demetrius. Back then, though, she'd been able to draw on the services of Inquisitor Hovash Phaelius. Her old master had been a thorough man, with a well-supplied armory and well-maintained apothecarian. And so her medical care, when needed, had been exemplary. Now, through a fog of pain suppressors, she barely knew where she was, let alone how reliable her treatment had been. Looking at Arunian, with his ghost-pale skin and flickering gaze, it was hard to be confident.
"Yes,"
was all she croaked, proudly. She gained strength after that. The chirurgeon shuffled away, coming back every few hours with more tinctures and needles. Servitors clunked and drooled around her cot, attending to the antiquated machines with their dumb, clumsy movements. Her sense of self, of place, of memory began to return. She remembered the long hunt, when it seemed like the world itself had turned against them all, and her master's retinue was picked off, one by one. During that time, she had never tried to persuade him to leave, to flee off-world from a terror that had become their enemy. An Inquisitor did not flee, not when there was quarry to hunt. Right until the end, she had assumed that he would discover who their hidden enemies were, and then find a way to counter them. But in that, she had miscalculated. Phaelius was dead now, as were all the others. Only she remained, a fugitive plucked from the shadows of the great hive spires and absorbed into another coterie of killers and misfits. Even then, death had still come for her in the deep catacombs under the palace itself, where Xenos and myth-pulled gods had fought amid the swirling shadows. But she had cheated it again, one more time. Now she breathed, painfully. She blinked. Painfully. She swallowed, and felt the rawness of her throat where the tubes had been. By the time she came fully back to her senses, the lumens in the chamber were dialed low. In the hazy murk, it took her some time to realize she was not alone.
"Welcome back, assassin," said Erasmus Crowell.
She had never spoken to him before. She had only ever heard the name Crowell when Spinoza had mentioned it, and such references had been fleeting and in haste. By the time the two of them had ended up in the same chamber at last, the lasbolts were already flying, and the greatest of Rassilo's hunters was coming for her with murder in their eyes. Still, it was hard to mistake him. He wore black robes trimmed with silver. His hair was slicked back to his skull, pulled away from a gaunt face of scars and sickness. He sat calmly, hands on his lap, still as the shadows around him. Only his voice, which had a soft, dry surface timbre, gave away a little more humanity. She tried to lift her head from the pallet and failed.
"Inquisitor," she croaked.
Crowell got up, tipped away the metal can of water by her cot, and replaced it with a fresh one. She took a cautious sip.
"I wish to give you longer to recover," Crowell said. "They're serious wounds. Spinoza thought you might die from them."
Spinoza. Luce Spinoza. The woman, Kral's interrogator, who had tracked her down and in all likelihood saved her life. She was cut from exceptional cloth, that one. Rougher, harder, more ebulliently physical. Khazad and she were similar in many ways, warriors schooled in the Imperium's imaginative arts of combat. But the man before her was a breed apart, frailer in body, it seemed, but with an evident mental strength that even now, even here, was capable of chilling with a word.
"Does she live?"
Khazad asked. It was hard to remember precisely how things had ended, down there in the deeps under these immense walls. "She lives, Emperor be praised. I think it would be very hard to end her, and I am grateful for that." Khazad swallowed again. It was slowly getting easier.
"Then can I..."
"Peace," said Kral quietly. "You are not under edict of interrogation. Questions will have to come when you are stronger. For the time being, I wish you to know you are safe." Khazad smiled weakly.
"Nowhere safe."
"Maybe not. But there are degrees of danger. Do you know where you are?" Khazad nodded. "Most who come here never leave," Kral said. "You, of course, may leave whenever you wish. I know a little of the Shoba doctrine. You will need to locate those who wronged you."
"Yes,"
she said vehemently.
"I know names. If any still live..."
"Indeed. And I approve of the sentiment." He leaned forward into the pool of murky light, and Khazad saw the deep rings of black under his eyes. "You must take whatever path seems right to you," he said, "either alone or, if you choose, with us. Spinoza might have told you I habitually worked alone. That was partially true for a long time, but things are becoming perilous here. An assassin of the Shoba school would be of use to me. It wouldn't be the safest option, given how things are. But think on it when you're recovered." Khazad looked at him directly.
"No time needed. I stay here."
Kral raised an eyebrow. "Really? You don't wish to consider it?"
"Spinoza trust me. I trust her. Have no other master. You will do."
Kral chuckled. "I see." He got up, and Khazad saw for the first time how lean he was out of the armour she'd witnessed him wearing before. In his long robes, he looked like a coiled whip, frayed and flaking from overzealous use. "Get better, then," he said, seriously. "Get stronger." Khazad began to feel her awareness slipping away again. Irunian must have piped something down the tubes that still ran into her arteries, something that would knock her out and accelerate the healing that still needed to be done.
"We'll be ready,"
she said fiercely, keeping her eyes open as long as she could. "Good," said Kral. "They'll come for you again now. They'll come for me, too."
"Yes."
"Just so you know, it isn't over." Sleep rose up to smother her again, hot and cloying.
"Never is,"
she murmured, thinking back over all those injuries.
"Always start again."
Maldo Rivas, too, was recovering. His body, too, was a thing of consummate toughness, honed and shriven over decades until every muscle was like boiled leather, held together by its scars and bearing the marks of its armour pieces. He had limped out of the catacombs with Spinoza, his carapace plate riddled with dents and his helm visor blurred with his own blood. That was the way such things usually ended, of course, so he had no complaints about it. Perhaps, though, as he aged, the recovery times were lengthening a little. It had been 8 years now with Kral. Before that, he had served as a sergeant with another inquisitorial detachment, and before that, he had been a private soldier in a stormtrooper division on permanent void duty. His memories beyond that were blurred, perhaps due to the strain of near-constant combat, perhaps due to the after-effects of the mind wipes he had undergone multiple times during preliminary training. There was no true beginning for him, no commencement, just a growing set of impressions, steadily becoming firmer, solidifying into his current state as Kral's loyal killer. At times, he would dream of another time and another world, empty skies of pale green, a dusty plain stretching away towards gauzy horizons, a child running in terror from the iron ships hanging in the grit-blown air. Even now, after a routine action, while recuperating in Corvain's medical bays, he might remember the nights he had endured in the Scola, stinging from the welts left by the instructor's electro-whips, his lips bloody from constant recitation of battle doctrine. He could revisit himself as an adolescent sometimes, crying angrily into the thin sheets of his cot, fists balled against the bolsters, exhausted, broken. All that psycho-training had left its mark, bludgeoning out the weaker elements, leaving only what was necessary for his vocation. Like so many others in the service of the throne, he had been forged, hard-tempered, then remade. Corvain, for one of Rivas's experience, might have been considered a less than optimal posting. Another man in his position might have agitated hard for promotion, for transfer to a personal detachment in a more prestigious location, or even command of an active duty regiment in some branch of the mainstream militarum. Rivas, though, knew what Kral offered. Some inquisitors were sadists, treating their troops as expendable resources. Others were flamboyant mavericks, swaggering around the Imperium's possessions like temporal lords and holding sway over fiefs in the name of none but themselves. Kral was simpler to understand. He cared little for the outward ostentation of his office, but maintained an orderly, active program of investigation. He had high expectations of those in his service, but was solicitous over their well-being. That engendered loyalty in excess of that guaranteed by standard indoctrination alone. For those who served long enough, it inculcated something close to devotion. And yet, it was still possible to have one's faith shaken, to be exposed, even briefly, to a wider world. For a very short time down in those lightless pits, Rivas had fought alongside custodians. They had barely noticed him, in all likelihood, and his own contribution to the encounter under the walls had been little better than nominal. And yet, still, he had served alongside them. A man might live for 100 years and never see such a sight. He might tell stories of it, with every detail perfectly represented, and none would believe him. Now, in the shadows of the citadel's interior, Rivas stood on the edge of the training square, his linen jerkin soaked with sweat. He tried to recall how they had moved, how they had handled those crackling staves. Perhaps there was something to learn from it, however imperfectly or clumsily. There was always room for improvement, to become a better servant of the throne, and it was hard to imagine more exalted role models. But in truth, there was no emulating such paragons, not even by degree. They were as far above him as he was above the wretched and disease-blighted masses of the Underhives. Already, the experience had begun to seem like a dream, a too vivid vision provoked by fever. Back in Corvain, all was dark again, all was stained and old. They had been like shards of gold in an imagined sunrise, fleeting, seen from a distance, a reminder of another possible world of myth and forgetfulness. He pushed himself from the wall, flexing his aching arms. The baton was greasy in his grip. In the centre of the training square was a padded column 2 meters high, a static opponent of limited use for honing his skills. It would make him stronger, though. The overhead lumens flickered as he padded onto the mat, rehearsing the litanies of manual combat, the same ones he had been taught in the Scola and had used ever since. The sodium tubes above him shook as he thudded the baton home, swinging heavily, panting and throwing sweat from his forehead. As he worked, as he pommeled and struck, he had the golden giants in his mind's eye the whole time, those titans of combat whose movements had been so fast as to be nearly impossible to follow. There was so much to do still, so far to go before he reached the limit of his potential and the absolute satisfaction of what the throne could demand. Once they had been seen, they could never be forgotten, and could only remain there, visions goading him towards greater accomplishment. There would never be fighting like it again. If he had never lived to see another day, it would still have all been worth it, just for that.
"Again, now," he murmured to himself, getting ready for another bout. "Faster this time, more accurate."
The lumens pulsed, as if in readiness. Sweat ran in thin trails down his flushed skin. He hefted the baton and started again. Now Terra was her home. Spinoza's time on the throne world had been so short. She had seen many planets in her time, and each had left their mark, though none had claimed her so completely as this one. She had ingested its poisons and breathed its soot-heavy atmosphere. She had observed the blush fade from her skin to be replaced by the grey pallor that all wore here. She had already been swallowed up, enveloped and weighted down, until there was nothing left but this place, this endless city, this press of thousands upon thousands of souls, all of them clamouring for something, anything. Now she stared at herself in her small mirror above her personal hygiene station, lit on all sides by unforgiving lumen strips. She saw the harder edge to her jaw, the deeper lines around her eyes. Her hair, which had always been a pale blonde, was now bleached almost entirely white. Terra's mark had been made, and the process could only continue. She had a choice now. She could either do what Rasselot had done and indulge in augmetics and rejuvenate to hide the damage, or adopt her master's policy of letting the world do its worst. The latter was the more honest course and appealed to her innate sense of conventional piety, but the temptation to fight against the grime was still strong. There were things she could do, techniques she could adopt, all of which required coin, which she had enough of, and time, which she didn't. It was most likely, then, that she would let it slide and gradually become one with this place, just another grey-skinned, dark-eyed cadaver stalking the labyrinths. She splashed cold water over her face, rubbed the dry skin, and turned away from the mirror. Her private chambers were set on the northern wall of the citadel, near the summit, and only overhung by the topmost gun emplacements. Her sole view of the city outside was through a single set of narrow, reinforced windows. She could see towers crowding the night beyond, rank upon rank of them, each one surmounted by glowing marker lights and glittering from their thousands of tiny viewports. Pools of smoke from the incinerators and cathedral furnaces rolled lazily across the darkness, snagging on the Gothic turrets and spilling back down into the narrow canyons between. The palace itself was far to the north, a long way out of sight. Its grandeur might have been a world away from the crumbling mazes before her, and yet it never left her mind. She had come closer to it than she had ever dared to hope, albeit via buried ways that gave her little sight of the immense structures above. Since returning to Corvain, she had pondered little else. The ranks of statues forgotten in the deep dark, the foundations buried under centuries of accumulation, the smell of ancient dust in her nostrils, deposited in another age, and only stirred again by their brief intrusion. Kraul had gone further in, she knew. He had said nothing of what he'd seen, and she had learned better than to ask, but something had changed in him. He'd been brought out unconscious. When he'd finally stirred again, his first expression had been almost rapturous, as if he were still in the presence of something phenomenal, before he'd blinked, winced, and realized that it had gone. After that, there had been a change, some faint mark left on him. She could never quite put a finger on what it was. He remained dry, soft-spoken, occasionally sardonic, but an alteration had taken place. Perhaps that was inevitable. You did not come so close to such powers without being changed by them. Even as Terra was moulding her, so the palace, or what had taken place within it, had changed Kraul, and only time would tell where those changes would lead. And then there was the heresy of it, the Xenos, the monster dredged up from the profane reaches of the void and delivered into the very precincts of holiness. The thought of it disgusted her beyond endurance, just as the memory of its many depravities still polluted her mind. She had seen foulness before, but never so close to the heart of what she had been charged to protect. It should never have got so far in. Now, whenever she closed her eyes to begin her devotions, she would see its hollowed-out face. Kraul said it was dead now, killed by the custodian Navradaran, its body destroyed. She had to believe that. And yet, in the dark hours of the night, when she awoke, she would still catch it staring at her through the window, or back at her in the mirror, or from behind her altar, licking its dark tongue around its bone-pale lips. Just visions.
It was weakness to entertain them at all. To combat them, she read the catechisms aloud. She returned to the Progea rhythms again, clutching to their solidity and simplicity, trusting that in time faith would dispel such phantoms from her unconscious mind. She donned her robes, pinning the rosette to her breast and adjusting the heavy fabric of her cassock. In the far corner of the chamber, hoisted on a metal rack and surrounded by ritual candles, was Argent, the modified Crozius Arcanum gifted her by the Space Marine chaplain, Erastus. Simply laying eyes on it made her fingers itch to grasp it, to take it out into the darkness and use it to tear the shadows apart. Physical violence was easy. It was pure, and it was sanctioned. Other forms of service, particularly those practiced here, were harder. A chime sounded, and a corresponding lumen bead spread a soft blush of red across her wax-stamped purity seals. "Interrogator," came a thin voice over her private comm, Anila's by the sound of it.
"I am aware of the hour," Spinoza replied, pulling a cloak over her shoulders. "I shall be there presently."
The link cut out. The candle flames fluttered in the hot air, sending their warm light flickering over Argent's sacred outlines. It had never been over. The short time for respite, a mere breath, a single heartbeat, had passed. Now, it would all start again.